Madam, I'm Eugene Barnett, one of the victims of the Centralia conspiracy. Centralia conspiracy is an important case in labor history. There was a raid on a union hall, the Lumber Workers Industrial Union of the IWW, on November the 11th, 1919, by a group of vigilantes organized by the Southwest Lumber Barons of the state of Washington to break up the union there and drive it out when the Lumber Trust had decided that the union was becoming too strong for them. But first I want to go back and tell you about how I began in the labor movement. I was born in the state of North Carolina, in the Blue Ridge Mountains. Born in a little log cabin where my daddy was born, my granddaddy was born there, and my great-granddaddy felled the trees and hewed the logs and built it. My ancestors came from England, moved up into the Blue Ridge Mountains because they had the theory the mountaineers are always free. That was one way of getting away from the class struggle. And there they live to this day. In 1898, when the coal barons of West Virginia had locked out the union miners there who had organized and gone on strike in the national strike for the 8-hour day, my daddy was one of the men that was recruited from the hills of North Carolina to go out there and break the strike. About 40 families were moved out there. The superintendent from the mine had been born down there in North Carolina. He'd gone to school with my daddy, and he knew that the people down there knew nothing about unions, knew nothing about the conditions in the industry, and they made ideal strike breakers. Knowing nothing of it and having no union ideas, they were just what they wanted. So he came there to recruit the strike breakers. When we got out in West Virginia, we found the coal miners camped on a gravel bar on the Kentucky side of Tug River. The river was the line between West Virginia and Kentucky. An injunction had been obtained and they'd been forced out of the state. So there they were camped, and we could hear their children crying all day long. It seemed they cried incessantly. So I asked another kid who was playing with me there one day, a boy about my own age. He said, "Why do those kids cry all the time? Seem like they cry all the time." "Well," he said, "they're hungry. They don't get anything to eat. Their daddy joined that old union and it don't give them anything. All they get one loaf of bread a week. And that's all they got." And that seemed to be the opinion of the grown-ups around there, too. They seemed to think the same way. A little later, when the company preacher there, owned by the company, like everything else in the camp, took up a collection for the starving Chinese and sent a boxcar load of groceries away that he had bought out of the company store, where groceries were 3 times as high as they were in Charleston or New York or some other place outside the jurisdiction of the coal company. I asked my daddy why he didn't donate that to the kids over across the river. Well, he said their daddies were no account. They could have had the job he had, but they wouldn't work. And so that settled it. I was just a kid, and I couldn't argue with him about it. But it didn't seem right to me. I could hear those kids crying. I knew they was hungry. And I figured that they should have something to eat. I couldn't hear the Chinese crying over in China. And I doubt now whether that ever got out of the state of West Virginia. Of course, at that time, just being a kid, I couldn't reason that far. However, seeing things since the way it goes, why, I doubt very much whether it ever reached the Chinese. But at any rate, my daddy put me to work in the mine. He went and bought me a cap, bought the smallest they had in the company store, pinned it up with a mule shoe nail so it was small enough to fit me, hold a lamp on my head, put me to work about a mile underground. I was tending a trap door that regulated the air currents in the mine. They had no fans there. All they had was a furnace, big fire there. They'd tunnel down from the top of the hill and build a grate down in the mine there out of railroad rails, and they'd pile coal on that and set it afire, and this fire and burning would get its draft around through the mine from the entrance, and that way they got a draft through the mine. Of course, it'd take 5 or 6 hours when the miners fired their shots for the smoke to clear out. But you didn't wait for that smoke to clear out. You went to work. The superintendent said that helped to fan the smoke out. So that was another way of economizing on fans. So we'd go to work in the mines before daylight, and we'd come out after dark. For that kind of work, I got 75 cents a day. The camp there was honeycombed with Pinkerton and Bald and Phelps detectives. Once in a while, a union organizer would drift in, trying to reorganize the district. And In a few days, he'd be found out that he was an organizer, and they'd find him hanging on a beech tree out in front of the company store. Or perhaps some bald and south of Pinkerton would knock him on the head out in the railroad track, kill him. It was in broad daylight and too many witnesses. Well, the detective would probably have to leave camp for 2-3 weeks and come back. No one was ever arrested for it. No trials were ever held for anyone that was killed in that way. And there was plenty of them killed while we were there. On one occasion, Mother Jones came in there, stood on the mail crane where the passenger train came through and took the mail on the fly, made a speech to the miners, and she was ridden out of camp on a rail. In the 6 years that I was there, I heard enough of unionism, in spite of the detectives, to find out a little about it and want to get where there was a union. So I ran away and went to Pennsylvania. I landed up there in Somerset County, at Jerome, Pennsylvania, went to work in the mines there. It was still a non-union field, but it was close enough to the union field that conditions were better. The coal company steering the union had improved conditions in order to keep it out. So we had the 8-hour day. They had fans there to take the air out of the mine. And they paid $2.34 a day for the same work that I had done down in West Virginia for 75 cents a day. So I thought if it improved conditions that much, getting close to a union field, it'd really be heaven if I got where they had a union. So I moved again. I landed in Shadyside, Ohio. I went to work in the Putney mine there and joined the union. From that time on, I've been a union man. I liked the way they walked around and said what they thought. They could go around with their head up like an American man should and speak their mind. They didn't have to worry about who was listening to them and glance over their shoulder every time they started to say something to see if there was someone listening and they might be shot down as soon as night come or even before, as often happened in West Virginia. So living like American men, why, that became my religion. I believed in it. I believed in the union. I tried to spread it everywhere I went. I wasn't content to just be a card packer walking around with a union card in my pocket and capitalistic ideas in my head. I wanted to help do something. I wanted to help build a union and spread it in all industry, not only in my own industry. I felt it was good for the whole working class, and I worked to that end. And any time I was asked to serve on a pit committee or a grievance committee or as president of my local or anything like that, I accepted the office and served to the best of my ability. I moved on from one coal camp to another, and wherever I went, I found that the workers get just what their union is strong enough to take for them. Makes no difference what the law is, makes no difference what party's in power, or anything else. If you haven't got a union strong enough to enforce the law and to enforce your demands, you get absolutely nothing. In Colorado, the 8-hour day was on the statute books for 11 years before it was enforced in the mines. And we didn't get it until our union was strong enough to enforce the law and take it for us. The same thing was true up in the Northwest when I came on out there in 1910. I found that the loggers up in the state of Washington were working 11 hours a day. They were sleeping 40 men in a bunkhouse, double-decked bunks on the wall, just one little window, just one sash, not really a window, just a half a window for a bunkhouse. You'd open the door and open that one sash, and that's all the ventilation you got. You worked all day in the rain, came in at night and hung your old soggy clothes up around the one stove in the center of the room with wires going out from it in all directions like a spider web, and they hung there and steamed all night. And you slept there in that steam. That's the only bath you got. There was no other facilities for one. You got your steam bath there every night. There was no place to wash your clothes. If you wanted to wash up, the only thing you could do was go out and hunt up an old coal oil can on Sunday and boil up your clothes like a hobo down in the jungle. There was no place to wash, no place to take care of them. If you moved from one camp to another, you had to go with your roll of blankets on your back. You looked like a bunch of snails going down the highway. So when the loggers began organizing, trying to build an industrial union for to do away with those conditions, I was strong for it. And I did everything I could to further the union idea and help build it up. In 1919, when the lumber barons in Centralia decided to run the union out of Centralia, I was secretary of the United Mine Workers Local at Copiah, 11 miles out of Centralia. And they held a meeting in the Elks Club there about 3 weeks prior to this raid, and selected a committee. They gave F.B. Hubbard, the president of the Southwest Washington Lumbermen's Association, their power to create a secret committee to devise ways and means of running this union out of town. And they were so sure of themselves that they went and published an item in the daily newspaper there telling of this, telling how he had been empowered to select his own committee for this purpose. When I heard of that, I went down and I got 40 copies of that paper, and I marked the article, and I put them in mailboxes, in farmers' mailboxes out between there and the mine, to acquaint the farmers with what was going to happen. Because I figured that the farmers, seeing this trouble coming, would try to head it off, if for no other reason, for the sake of keeping down their taxes. Because it was plain to anyone, if there was trouble there, well, there was going to be trials and court procedure and so forth, that would raise their taxes or put their county in debt. So I figured from that angle, if for no other, they might protest. On November the 11th, the day the raid occurred, I was in town that afternoon. Happened to go in by accident. I'd even forgot that it was Armistice Day. I'd been out coyote hunting out there in the hills the previous few days because we were on strike, the National Coal Strike of 1919. It began November the 1st, and I was out on that. All the miners were on a strike at that time. So I hadn't been taking much interest in what was going on. I hadn't been keeping track of the days. I was going out and having some fun with my hounds out in the woods, chasing coyotes, enjoying myself, enjoying a vacation, which a worker seldom gets, only when he is on a strike or something like that. Of course, it was a vacation without pay, but nevertheless, I was enjoying it. So I went into town that day and was visiting with a friend in a hotel adjoining this hall when the raid occurred. I saw the parade come up the opposite side of the street. I saw them park two army trucks out there, which they planned to load the men that they took out of the hall in, as they had done on a previous occasion some months before when they raided another hall about two blocks from there. They parked an army truck there, and they took the men out of the hall and lifted them by their ears like they were loading hogs, and loaded them into this truck, took them down between Centralia and Chehalis, and forced them to run the gauntlet, run between two lines of men armed with gas pipes and clubs and rubber hose or whatever they had. If they had nothing else, they'd take a kick at them or slug them with their fists, use whatever weapon they had for to beat them up and run them out. Told them to go on towards Chehalis and keep on going, not to come back. So they planned the same thing for this day. Before ever the trouble started, I saw men in the ranks of this parade with ropes and guns and gas pipes. So I knew what was coming. You could feel it in the air. You didn't even have to see it. There was a tensity there that you could absolutely feel. They marched on up to the next corner above the hall and came back on the side next to it and were bunched up by Lieutenant Fred Carmier, the man there that ran a confectionery store down on Main Street. And he was marshal of the day and mounted on horseback. He gave the order, bunch up, men, and they halted in front of the place and bunched up. The men in the front lines of this contingent turned around and faced the hall. Some of them stood in a crouched position, like a runner waiting for the signal to make his start, and were absolutely turned around in ranks. As the marshal of the day rode on back along the ranks, giving orders, these fellows who had turned around in ranks would make false starts. It wasn't the right order. They were waiting for a given order. And when it came, Fred Carmier, the marshal of the day, blew a whistle, and they converged on the door of that hall from both ends of this contingent that had stopped there. Came in a wedge shape right for the door, and they smashed the doors and windows, and the first man that stepped inside the hall was shot down. When I saw them attack the place, I thought there was going to be a fight. I didn't know that anyone in the hall had guns. I'd been in there a short time before, and I hadn't seen any guns. There were only four or five men in the hall. So it was as much a surprise to me as to anyone when the shooting started. When I saw them make the attack, I threw my coat, pulled it off and threw it on a sewing machine in the lobby of the hotel and started for the door. But before I reached the door, the shooting started, so I turned around and walked back over to where I threw my coat. I had intended to go out and take part in the fight. I figured there'd be a fight, and I was going to take my beating along with the rest of the boys. But before I got there, the shooting started. Then they started coming into the hotel, going through into the back to break through a partition door back there to come into the back of the hall, try to get in behind the boys and surround them. They were coming in there with guns. One fellow had a hand axe, so they came in and they broke this door with the hand axe to go in through. While they were coming in, there was a man came in there who owned a grocery store there, Bill Scales. He's dying with a cancer up there now. He's got one eye eat out and his ear off. I saw him not so long ago. And he came in through there, and I was acquainted with him because I'd traded at his store at one time. He had a grocery store there in town. So I told him to warn these fellows to be careful with the guns because the proprietor's wife had gone into the back. And the way they were coming in there, their mouths drawn like horse hairs and everything, you could see that they were scared, and I figured if even a chipmunk moved, they'd be apt to shoot. So I told him to tell them to be careful with those guns. He looked at me, but he didn't make any reply. So the next fella come in, a big strapping young fella in sailor's uniform with a big navy coat. I told him myself to be careful that there's a lady back there. He looked at me and made no reply, but went on through. So when they broke through in there, they found that the boys had ran out the back of the hall. Wesley Everest, the man who had been shooting from inside the hall, was a returned soldier himself. He was wearing his uniform that day, and he was shooting with a gun that he had brought back from France. He'd been cited for bravery over there and had been denied his medal because they had found that he was a radical. He told the boys that day, he said, "I fought for democracy in France, and I'm going to fight for it here." He said, "The first man that comes in this hall, he's going to get it." So he made his stand right in the middle of the floor that day. After he ran out the back, they chased him, shooting at him and him shooting back at them. They ran about a quarter of a mile from there, ran down to the Skookumchuck River. And he started to wade the river, but for some reason or other, he turned around and come back. Came back on the bank, and he said, "If there's an officer in the bunch, I'll surrender. If there's not, lay off of me." They attacked him, and he killed Dale Hubbard down there, nephew of the president of the Southwest Washington Lumbermen's Association, the man who had planned this raid. Then his gun jammed, and they overpowered him. He threw his gun in the river when it jammed and started to fight with his fist, but he was no match for 8 or 10 men, so they overpowered him, put a hair rope around his neck, tied it behind an automobile, and drug him back into town behind an automobile. They drug him down within a half a block of the city jail and hung him on a telephone pole. There was people there clawing at him. They were jabbing him with bayonets, and no one in that crowd except one little woman that weighed about 90 pounds had nerve enough to say anything or do anything. Her daddy was a union man, a railroad man. So she slapped some of their faces, told them what a bunch of cowards they were, and pulled him down. They took him and threw him in the corridor of the jail. He was unconscious from the beating and dragging and everything, and he lay there all afternoon. That night, about 8 o'clock, the mayor of the city turned the lights out all over the town. While it was in darkness, the mob went in and got him again. A man who is said to be a prominent doctor there used a razor on him, castrated him, like you would an alley cat, if you'd be that cruel. Then he washed his hands on the lawn of Timberman's lawn there at a hydrant, and they went on down and hung him on the wagon bridge that crosses the Chehalis River, about a mile out of town. Later in the night, they came back, turned their headlights on the body, shot it full of holes, cut the rope, and let him fall in the river. Then they divided up the rope among themselves as souvenirs. I was back there a few years ago, and they told me that some of the businessmen there still have their piece of rope. They show it around to special friends once in a while. Piece of rope that Wesley Everett was hung with. 3 days later, the assistant attorney general came over there, and he said, "We've got to get that body." He said, "If the unions get a hold of it, mutilated the way it is, and get pictures of it in the union record and the other labor papers, why, they'll have us pictured as a bunch of morons all over the United States, because we've got to get it." So they drug the river and got the body, brought it up there, took some of his fellow workers out of the city jail there, and forced them to bury him out there along the railroad track. That was the unknown soldier's grave he got for fighting for democracy here in his own land, fighting for the right of the workers to join a union of their own choice without the boss's permission, to do away with rotten conditions and long hours and low wages. They don't care a darn about the worker. All this noise about the unknown soldier's grave and all that stuff is just a lot of poppycock. Whenever a man makes a fight for his own rights or for his own interests, why, any old grave's good enough for him. They'd even consider a dog better, especially if it happened to be their own dog. After that, every man in that community that was considered anywhere sympathetic to the organization at all was arrested and thrown into jail on one pretext or another. Mrs. McAllister, the proprietor's wife, in whose hotel I was when this happened, was arrested and placed in jail, and she was kept there for 27 days trying to make her say that I wasn't in there. She was an old lady born in Missouri, she was 60-odd years old. But still, they kept her in jail 67 days trying to make her lie. But she was made out of too stern a stuff. When the trial came along, well, she came up and told the truth. On my way home that night after the raid, I told a farmer out there along the route what had occurred, and he went into town and told them what I had said. So they come out the next day and they got me. The first thing the prosecuting attorney said to me was, "Barnett," he says, "we know you had nothing to do with this, but unless you keep your mouth shut, we're going to send you up." Well, I said, "I don't believe in that kind of stuff. I don't believe in raids. We pay taxes in this country to have law and order. And if those men were committing any crime, they should have been arrested and tried the same as any other criminal. And we have plenty of laws to take care of them and plenty of honest men that would sit on the jury and convict them if they were guilty." So I said, "If I'm called as a witness, I'll tell the truth, just what happened." They said, "If that's the way you feel about it, we'll lock you up." So I was locked up. And when the case was brought to trial, I was charged with being the man who did the actual killing of Warren O'Grim, the vigilante for whom we were tried. We were tried for one man. There was 4 men killed there that day of the vigilante group, and we were tried for one of them, for Warren O'Grim. The prosecution tried to place him down at the intersection of the street, instead of in the doorway leading the raid, where witnesses for the defense said that he was, and where I saw him. At this trial, they had a special school for their witnesses about a block from the courthouse, where they trained them to go through different pantomimes and different things and to say certain things. For instance, one fellow there had got shot in the arm, just a superficial wound in the arm. When Grimm was shot, he had crushed his stomach and walked down around the corner and fell again down around the corner there. So this man's name was Fitzer that was shot in the arm. So they schooled him to come up there and say it was he that walked down around the corner there holding his wounded arm across his stomach. That to get Grimm away from the door there where he was actually shot. The prosecution, at the beginning of the trial, said they would stand or fall on the issue of whether the hall was raided. But in spite of all their tactics of keeping the evidence out, and their prejudiced court and everything else, we proved so conclusively that they did raid the hall that they backed down on that later on, denied saying it, and based their whole prosecution on the fact that some of the boys had fired shots from outside of the hall in trying to defend it. The courtroom was packed with about 400 legionnaires during this trial. They're under salary, for atmosphere, and they also brought down a company of National Guard from Camp Lewis and camped them on the courthouse lawn and maneuvered them so that they met the jury every time they went to lunch, going and coming. In that way, they secured a second-degree verdict. The second-degree verdict in the state of Washington calls for 10 to 20 years. When they brought in their verdict, they also brought in a recommendation of leniency. The judge leaned as hard as he could. He gave us 25 to 40 years, a minimum sentence that was 5 years greater than the maximum that the law called for. Throughout this entire trial, there was a labor jury there, which was composed of men from different labor councils in the Northwest, American Federation of Labor councils, delegates from these unions. And they sat throughout the 13 weeks of the trial just the same as the regular jury, heard the evidence and rendered their decision the same as the regular jury, except that they had nerve enough to stick to their verdict when they arrived at it, while the real jury compromised. Their first vote was unanimous. We have affidavits to that effect now, but they got to arguing among themselves and what would happen to them if they brought in that verdict, and what would happen to us, and they compromised and brought in this second-degree verdict. I want you to bear in mind that this labor jury was from an organization that was prejudiced against the lumber workers, and which considered it a dual organization. So the fact that they were there proves just how raw the whole thing had been. It was even so raw that the Union Record, which was the American Federation of Labor newspaper in Seattle, had its doors padlocked because it told the truth about the trial and about the raid. Eight of us were convicted of second-degree murder and sentenced to 25 to 40 years in the state penitentiary at Walla Walla. I served 11 years and a half of that sentence and came out of there in May 1931. To take care of a wife that was dying with a cancer. All during my time in prison, they had used every means they could to wean me away from the labor movement. They'd come to me and tell me that if I'd quit the union, I could be out. I'd go up in front of the parole board, and I'd find issues of the Labor Defender, which is published by the International Labor Defense, and of the Industrial Worker, and Solidarity, and the Industrial Pioneer, and other labor papers on the desk there in front of the parole board, and they'd ask me what I wrote articles to those papers for. If I'd just quit that stuff, I'd have more chance to get out. But I told them that those unions were supporting my family and were trying to help me and trying to get me out of there when they were holding me in there when they knew I was innocent, and that as long as I was there, I would do what I could to pay back what they were doing for me. They would go to my wife and to my mother, and they would tell them the same thing. Tell them that if they'd come down there and get me to quit the union, why, I could be out. They'd say, Gene's all right, but he got in bad company. But I told them that I was in the very, very best company I could get in. I was in there with union men, and there's no better men on the face of the earth. The day that I was released from there, the governor was there. He called me on the carpet, and he says, Barnett, he said, I'm going to turn you loose to go out and take care of your wife. But he said, don't you talk to any union man. Don't you write anything for any union paper or have anything to do with any unions, because if you do, it'll just be too bad for you. I went in there a union man, and I come out a union man. I came out and I borrowed money and I took my wife to a sanitarium back in Savannah, Missouri. And when the 6 months reprieve expired, due to the care that I had given her, she was still alive. So the governor sent me a parole, and I was placed on parole. The average prisoner, criminal, serves about a year on parole in the state of Washington. But being an extra bad man, being a union man and not guilty in the first place, I had to serve 3 years on parole. My wife died about 9 months after I came out. I brought her back to Carson, Washington, and buried her there alongside of her mother. Then I went back to work in the mine. But one of the first tasks I had when I come out of there was to help reorganize the local up there. The United Mine Workers had been broken up in that field while I was in prison, and the miners were working up there for as low as $3.50 a day when the union scale was $7.05. But I helped to reorganize the local and went back to work. At the present time, I'm running a fox farm up in Idaho. I got rheumatism after that, and I had to make a living some way. I was in the hospital, and I came out on crutches, so I got 3 silver foxes and started the fox farm. And I'm living at Grangeville, Idaho now, operating that fox farm. I built up now to where I have 120 foxes on the ranch, starting with only 3, hobbling around on crutches and building my pen. So you can see what the labor prisoner is up against when he comes out of those places. It is for that reason that you find in the ranks of labor men who are loyal to the different defense organizations, because all they have to fall back on in time of need after they come out, in case of sickness or anything else, is the defense organization. Centralia is not an isolated case. There's cases like this coming up every day. We're on the eve of another world war now, and there'll be plenty of Centralias come up as this thing goes on and the struggle becomes more intense. So I want to say to you here tonight, regardless of everything else, build your union. That's where your real defense is. That's the one thing that can protect you. Up in the state of Washington now, we have a case similar to Centralia. The law case up there in Aberdeen. The man was at his union meeting and his wife was murdered. He's been tried in every way that they could.